Well, good morning. First of all, I just want to say that it has been an honor and a privilege to get more opportunities to share the word. This summer, as most of you know, our pastor has been on sabbatical. And so as pastoral assistant, I've just been given the opportunity to have a few more opportunities than normal to share the word, and it's been an honor and a privilege. If you're not there already, please open up your Bibles. I think it's 7:18 in the Pew Bible. We're going to be looking at Mark. We're almost to the end of chapter 6. It's hard to believe that we're almost 4 weeks and we're still in chapter 6, but we'll get there. Some of your youngins may graduate college by the time we do, but we'll get there. And so if you would open up with me, if you're not there, to chapter 6, and we're going to be looking at 45 through 52 like Chelsea just read. And so I'm going to read it again just to have it fresh in our minds, and then we'll see what the Lord has prepared for us today. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida. Well, he dismissed the crowd, and after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. You see a concept in this passage that's revolving around water. Now, water is a very interesting thing. Water can give life. If you think about it, we need water to live. Our bodies are X amount of percent of water, and so we need that to function and live. But water is a powerful thing. You may think about how lately the ALS challenge, that where people put ice in a bucket of water and they pour it on somebody's head. And so the idea is that there's just this rush of water, but it's very powerful. If you've ever been under that just extreme amount of pressure, water can be very powerful. Or you may think of a factory where it's hydroelectric, where that means it's powered, the electricity is actually powered by water. It's a very powerful thing. It can also cage the unknown. Sailors, I'm a huge Pirates fan, and I don't mean like a team or anything like that. I love old Pirates. Blackbeard is like my hero. I have a bumper sticker that says it. And like used to when they'd be on the sea, they would view the water as a dangerous place. It was a treacherous place. There were sea monsters that they would think would come up and attack them in the middle of their voyage. So you know, you may watch Discovery Channel and you see Shark Week just finished up. And there's these deep creatures that live deep below the surface of the water that scientists are constantly trying to find out more about. There's a whole world down there. Also, in the Old Testament, there is imagery that comes with the idea of water. For example, in 2 Samuel 22:17, it talks about being drawn up out of many waters, like an issue, like a problem, that God would take him out of the many waters that encompassed his life. Or in Job 27:20, it says, "Terrors overtake him like a flood. In the night, a whirlwind carries him off." So there's this idea of struggle and turmoil and pain and suffering that comes with water. You may also think of storms and struggles in life, where natural disasters, where it floods a whole town and it wipes out the town completely. Often you may hear, or you may have referenced, that you're feeling overwhelmed and you're drowning. Or you may have said, I'm fighting the storms in life right now and I can't seem to find the clearing. There's all these ideas that sometimes storms and water and things like that, though they're good and life-giving, they also present a time of struggle. And so you may see right off the bat how this is going to relate with our text, in that we see the disciples have an encounter with water. But we also see Jesus has an encounter with water. And so I want us to have that mindset as we approach this text this morning. And our big idea is that Jesus, the Son of God, is always there in times of crisis. We're going to look at three crises that the disciples are facing in this text. And then we're going to see how Jesus in the end, just as a little spoiler alert, how he's the ultimate comfort for us in those times of crisis. So our first point this morning is that in times of crisis, Jesus helps us realign with the mission. Read with me back in 45 and 46. It says, immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. Now, there's our fun little word, if you remember from the very beginning of our Mark series. We talked about the word immediately, how that's going to be interjected in the Gospel of Mark a lot. And so here's our fun little word. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. Now, it's interesting to note that he is pushing it. The idea in the Greek is that he's actually pushing his disciples into the boat. They may not want to go, but they're being reluctant to his will, but he's pushing them into the boat to get them away from something. So we kind of get this sense that Jesus is uneasy about something that is happening. What is going on that makes him so kind of uncomfortable with his disciples being right there? Well, there may be two options that he's getting at. First, he may want to get them that rest that he had intended for them earlier. If you remember, right before the feeding of the 5,000, he wanted them to go and rest, but the crowd had actually followed them, cut their path off, and followed them, and they were not able to get that rest. So he knows that if he doesn't get his disciples the rest that they need, they can be burned out and overwhelmed. So he's pushing and ushering them off into the boat so that they could get some rest. Or two, and what is probably most likely, is he wanted to keep them from being wrapped up in the excitement. Jesus had just done a miracle of provision. Many of you in fellowship groups this week might have thought about how the feeding of the 5,000 related to Exodus and Moses, and how as he prayed for manna from the sky for food, how that could have been taken by the crowd as, wow, Jesus is something else. Like, he just made 5 loaves and 2 fish multiply to feed 5,000 men, not to mention women and children that were not counted in that count. So he's just done this miracle of provision. It would not be far off to imagine to see the people seeing Christ and this miracle as a sign of a prophet or a king. In fact, a parallel passage in John says that after the people saw the miraculous signs that Jesus did, they began to say, surely this is a prophet who is come into the world. Jesus, knowing this, that they intended to come and make him a king, withdrew again. They were going to make him a king by force, and he knew that if his disciples got caught up in that excitement, in this messianic movement, that they might miss the greater point of why he was here. And so he's ushering them into this boat to get them away from being entangled in this wrong perception of who he is and what he came to do. So he wants to make sure their focus is in the right place. So off in the boat they go. We see it, and after he had taken leave of them, which is probably more so the crowd than the disciples, after he taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. Now, if you've been with us on this journey, this is not an uncommon occurrence to you, that Jesus would go up somewhere, go alone somewhere to pray. In fact, in chapter 1, after he cast out many demons, it says he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. But the very next verse tells us that he went away to be alone and pray. Later in the gospel, we will see him do the same thing before he is to head to the cross. Why is he getting away to pray so often? Or is that the wrong question to ask? It is so that he can realign his mission with that of the Father. For many of us, when we endure a time of crisis in life, prayer is often our last resort. But it seems like Jesus has given us an example that when we experience a time of crisis, prayer should be our first ally, not our last resort. When Jesus experiences a critical moment in his ministry, the first thing he does is pray. He seeks to realign his vision with that of the Father. A famous Old Testament scholar of past years, George Adam Smith, once climbed Weisshorn above the Zermatt Valley in Switzerland, a big mountain, with his guide on a stormy day. They made the ascent on the sheltered side, so they're going up on the non-windy side, and they reached the top. Exhilarated by the thought of the view before him and the triumph of having attained this summit, he forgot about the gales, the strong winds that were blowing on the other side of the mountain. And so as he jumped up on the summit and he got excited, his guide quickly pulled him back down. And he later recants, he says, "But forgetting about the gale, I sprang to the top of the peak and was almost blown over the edge by the wind. But my guide grabbed me and pulled me down. And he shouted, 'On your knees. You are only safe here on your knees.'" Thus, not only is the safest place for us to be in a time of crisis on our knees, it is also the place, the only place, that allows us to communicate with the Father and realign our mission with his. This time is necessary for us to gain the understanding that God may be trying to, what he may be trying to do with us through this trial. And so the time we spend in prayer is especially most important as we find ourselves in the thick of the crisis. Which leads to our second point this morning, that sometimes in crisis we may feel alone and become afraid. As Jesus was praying, his disciples were making their way across the sea. You can see this with me in verse 47. "And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea." He meant to pass them by. So Jesus knows the struggle that his disciples are experiencing. Matthew, in his account, says the boat was a long way away. And John, in his, adds that it was 3 to 4 miles offshore. So they had made some progress in their journey, but they have really struggled in their journey. Think about a time when you really just, you needed to get away. You're going to go on a vacation and you just needed to get away. And all you've done for this last week is you've looked forward to getting away, from getting rid of work for a week, from getting rid of the hassles of life for a week. All you want to do is just go and lay by a pool somewhere in the middle of Florida, because that's where I'm from and it's beautiful down there. But all you want to do is get away, go to the beach, and just forget everything. But on your way, on your journey, you experience a little traffic getting out. Okay? You're frustrated. Or once you get on the road, you blow a tire. Many of you guys been in this kind of experience where all that joy that you had built up, all that excitement to get away, to get on this journey, has now become frustration. This is exactly what the disciples were experiencing. In fact, you may not know this, but I really did find this in a research book. No, I didn't. But the disciples actually created the song, "Row, Row, Row Your Boat." Do you know that? In fact, you can almost hear them as they're going along this journey and they're singing, "Row, row, row your boat, gently cross the lake. Merrily, 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 this trip's a piece of cake." But then, all of a sudden, the wind starts to blow a little bit, and the waves start to rock the boat, and their song that was so happy and free starts to change to, "Row, row, row your boat, back-breaking as can be. Sweating. Where could Jesus be? There are definitely times in life, and especially in ministry, that we experience good times. Things start off great. We're loving it. Jesus is just blessing us with all these great, fruitful opportunities in ministry. Everything's going smooth. The sails are up. We're catching the wind just right, blowing us along the river. However, there are also times when things aren't going so well. This might be a newsflash for some of you, but ministry's hard. Life is hard. You know, sometimes when we're complaining about our life, our spouse may lovingly look at us and just kind of, well, life's hard. What do you expect? Or our friends may kind of look at us like, duh, dude, you're going to experience hardships in life. But sometimes we get so caught up in how hard our life is that we start to feel alone. You may find yourself asking, Jesus, are you there? Why would Jesus allow me to be struggling across the sea? Is he not supposed to be with me? As we read through the Gospel of Mark, we see it time and time again that nothing good happens to the disciples when they get in a boat. It just doesn't. Earlier on in the chapter, there's this huge storm and Jesus is sleeping in the front. And they're like freaking out, panicking, and they're like, dude, guy's sleeping and we're about to get thrown overboard. And so you kind of have to imagine as he's saying, go, get in the boat and get over there. They're like, why? We're going to get thrown overboard or we're going to end up like Jonah in the middle of it and swallowed by a fish or something. Nothing's good going to come about this. Sometimes we miss the purpose of the trials in our life. Look with me back in the text where it says in verse 48, he saw that they were making headway painfully. He notices that they're struggling. And we may sit there and kind of think, like, how can he see this but not do anything about it? He notices that they're struggling. He did not rescue them immediately from the trying waters. Sometimes we will be tested, and Scripture tells us that we should not be at all shocked that we are enduring trials. James 1:2, it'll be on the screen behind me, says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. You may recall in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12, it says, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you. Our testing, our trials are a proving ground for faith. Later in the first chapter of James, it says that blessings to the man who remains strong in times of trial. Also, this struggle was not a surprise to Jesus. It did not catch him off guard that his disciples were struggling against the wind. Instead, he saw an opportunity to teach them something. How many times in life do we see the struggles and the trials that we face as opportunities? Do we see them as teaching moments, as Scripture calls them refining moments, shaking the impurities of our life, making us pure through the fire? We think of rough patches we go through, of some of us, as just things that we go through, but we lose sight that they might be something bigger, that Jesus is teaching us something. We also have this negative idea of trials. Some of you may be thinking every time I say trial, the image of a courtroom comes to mind and you have this person who's being convicted of a crime. There's this negative connotation that we have to shake as Christians with the word trial. Sometimes they are burning away the impurities. But no matter what the trial we are facing, Jesus always comes through. He always comes to our rescue, which is our third and final point this morning. But in that, in times of crisis, Jesus comes to our rescue. Look with me at verse 48. the last part of it. After he's watched them struggling, he comes to them. It says, "And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass them by. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out. For they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, 'Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid.' And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened." About the fourth watch of the night, Jesus comes to them. Now, this is not a term that we usually use, but it's kind of the idea of 3 to 6 in the morning. So when you put it that way, they've really been struggling all night. And if you remember that John says they're like 3 to 4 miles offshore, that's not that far when you've been rowing in a boat all night. And so he came to them about the fourth watch of the night. They had to be tired, right? They had to have been like, okay, this is getting old. Second, though, he came to them walking on the sea. Now, I don't know how many of you know exactly how hard it is to walk on water. But I thought if by now you're falling asleep on me, I'd wake you up by showing you exactly how hard it is to walk on water. Now, I'm probably not going to succeed here, but it's worth a shot. So I'm like right above the water right now. And the minute that I let go, I feel like I can do this. Well, that failed. Obviously, you expected me, or I hope that you expected me to fail. If you had more trust in me, we need to talk later. But I hope you get the idea that, seriously, there's no way this can happen. I mean, a lot of people understand this story of Jesus walking on the water. In fact, I was listening to a podcast this week, and they were in the community asking, who is Jesus? And one of the answers was this guy who walked on water. But that was it. That was all they knew of Jesus. And so, how on earth is he able to do this? Well, Colossians gives us an idea. Paul in Colossians says that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him and through him, all things were created in heaven and on earth. All things, that includes, believe it or not, water. Only God can walk on water. And Jesus is very intentional about what he does and what he allows his disciples to see and understand of him. And so what he does is he comes to them walking on the water. And all of a sudden, I can only imagine that at first the disciples start thinking, wait a second, I've heard this before. If you think about the story of Job. Now, Job's friends were always questioning why Job was so faithful in what he did and how he did it and believing in God and who God was. But one of Job's answers to the question of who is God is found in chapter 9, verse 8, and it'll be on the screen. But it says this, "Who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea?" Who alone can trample the waves of the sea? It's God. Only the Creator can do such a thing as walk on water. Jesus is displaying divine attributes for the disciples, and he's been doing it all throughout the book of Mark, but they're still not getting it, so he's going to do something else, and he's going to walk on water for them to see. If there was any doubt before as to who Jesus was, that he was God in the flesh, there could be none now. Now, I'm sure many of you have probably heard stories and skeptics out there who say, there's no way Jesus really walked on water. That there was this little reef. It amazed me as I was reading this week at all the stories that people could come up with to disprove the theory that Jesus walked on water. One was that there's this little reef that he was walking on, and he just kept walking on it out the sea. Another was that it was just an illusion that the disciples were so tired and the fog had just skewed their vision so much that he was actually walking along the shore. They just thought he was walking on water. That doesn't explain that the boat was 3 to 4 miles off the shore when he got there, but we won't go there. We question these miracles that Jesus has done. And every time that we question them, we try to figure out, could this really happen? How could this happen? I can't prove it, so I don't believe that it happened. But maybe when we do that, our focus is on the wrong aspect and the miracles. Because what's really important is the fact of who is doing the miracles. We always look for some proof that these miracles could actually happen, but Jesus is the point. It's not faith when we question what the miracle is. The focus is on the one who is doing them, not that they could actually happen. If you notice in the Gospels, it's never questioning that it actually happened. It's more astonishment that Jesus could actually do this. And this is only further explained when we see that he actually intended to pass them by. What? He sees them, but he's going to walk on by? How could he do this? Isn't he Jesus? Shouldn't he be like comforting them and rescuing them? This doesn't necessarily mean that he was going to just let them be pushed on their off their course, but that he wanted to make it a point that they saw him. However, their reaction in the crisis was not shock and awe. In fact, when we read on in verse 48 and 50, it says that they responded with fear and they cried out. They thought they were actually seeing a ghost. Now, this could have been because they were tired, as we talked about, or that it was probably foggy and the sun was preparing to rise, so it's that murky, kind of eerie feeling. But something was stopping them from seeing that it was actually Jesus. Their lack of faith was prohibiting them from seeing Jesus walking on the sea. In fact, in Matthew, Peter asks that if it was indeed Jesus, that he commanded Jesus to let him come out and walk to him on the water. He wanted to do exactly what Jesus was doing. And if this is Jesus, then I know I can do it because he will allow me to do it. And if you remember, he actually gets out of the boat and he starts to walk. And then he loses sight. And he loses his faith and he starts to sink. When we're facing times of trial, Jesus may be walking by so that we can know he is there, but our lack of faith might miss him. Notice what happens though. He doesn't rebuke them. He doesn't yell at them for their lack of faith. He doesn't make fun of them. I actually have this thought of Jesus, probably because I watched a lot of cartoons when I was a kid, but I have this thought that he's like walking up to them. If you ever remember in a cartoon when somebody enters a haunted house and like there's this like big ghost that comes out, you're expecting like this big terrifying person to come out, but all they do is just go, boo, and act like, gotcha, sarcastic. I just have this thought that Jesus is going to walk up to his disciples and just be like, boo, but I'm not a ghost. I gotcha. But he doesn't do that. No, instead, what does he do? He comforts them. He speaks 9 words of comfort. Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid. Sometimes when we or someone we know has experienced a trial in life, sometimes the easiest thing is to say, Jesus is here, it's okay. When a child is scared of the monsters under their bed, and I'm sure parents, you guys can relate to this. I can't, but I remember being a kid. When those monsters are under the bed, you don't go in there and tell how fairy tale these monsters are and how it's just silly that your kids are believing this. No, all you do is you comfort them and say, I'm here. It's okay. I'm here. Though we may have hard hearts and not understand everything that life throws at us, we can rest in the assurance that Jesus is here, that he is there. And there's so much more in those words, "it is I." Jesus is once again claiming to be God. In the Greek, the same two words, ego, eimi, are used in John when Jesus says the famous I am passages. I am the bread of life. I am living water. I am the resurrection and the life. But also in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, we call that the Septuagint, the same words are used in the story of Moses and the burning bush. Now, you may recall that story where Moses is standing on the mountain and this bush is burning, and God is telling him to go and free my people from the slavery of Egypt. And so he goes, and he doesn't want to go at first, and he's like, how will they know that you sent me? And God says, tell them I am has sent you. I am who I am, and that I am is sending you. And that's the exact same phrase that's used in our passage. So as Jesus is comforting his disciples in this time of trial, he's actually saying, I am. I'm God. I'm with you. I always have been. I always will be. And because of that, he finally gets into the boat. And the wind ceases. The struggles they were facing all night are replaced by astonishment. Now, this is not a good kind of astonishment. Instead, they have more questions than they did before. They have more questions than they do answers. And verse 52 really sums up their experience. It says this, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. It's so discouraging to see in the Gospels the disciples not get it. They've been with Jesus all along. They've been with him throughout his entire ministry, but it's hard when they don't get it. And we get this insight that they did not understand about the loaves, so now we're pushing back to the previous miracle. Remember when they said, how are we supposed to feed these people? And Jesus says, just feed them. But we don't, would you want us to go buy all this food? And he takes care of it. He blesses the loaves and the fish and he multiplies it. But we see this battle with the disciples. And I think it's one that we can easily relate to where we have heart knowledge and we have head knowledge. See, the disciples, they have the head knowledge. Man, they are with Jesus. They are tracking with him day in and day out. They see all these miracles. They think it's awesome what he's doing. They think, man, maybe this guy's for real. They know all the facts. They have a head knowledge. We often sometimes get caught up in the facts of Jesus or the theology that we know or the books and sermons that we can quote. We have the head knowledge, but the difference, and the difference for the disciples, and in a couple weeks or so, we're going to see in chapter 8 this change. But right now, they have the head knowledge, but they don't have the heart knowledge. Their hearts are still hardened to the gospel. And we have that head knowledge, but until we gain that heart knowledge, it doesn't become real. Jesus is just a guy. He's not the Savior until we receive him with our hearts, and our hearts are softened to the miracles and the Savior that he is. So I hope that this morning that you experience that heart knowledge. Sometimes it gets in the way and we miss many blessings in times of trial. We think that this is just a rough patch when really Jesus may be teaching us something. And the only thing that's going to help us gain that is one, prayer and knowing the mission. Two, that heart knowledge. Knowing that Jesus cares for us more than just putting us through a rough spell in life.